This is London Calling.
Hi, I'm Graham Mack, and my guest this week is Slim Jim Phantom, best known as the drummer in the Stray Cats. The guys started out in Long Island, and when they were still teenagers, made the move to London. I asked Jim about where they stayed when they came to town.
We were kind of homeless. Like, we had a little bit of money, so we got some flea bag kind of thing where we all slept in the same bed for, you know, a week or, you know. And then we were kind of rough, to be honest with you. We, like, stashed the stuff somewhere. I think we met someone that let us, like, leave a couple of suitcases under a bed. But then we were on our own, really. I remember sleeping outside a bunch of times in Hyde Park on the chaise lounges, and we would stay at movie theaters in Soho because you could pay one time at the beginning of the day and stay all night kind of thing. We couch surfed squats. We tried to find rock and roll people and rock and roll. And we'd get a copy of Time Out somehow from a bin and look through it and see what gigs were free kind of thing, or, you know, go to some gig and try to meet some rock and roll people, and they would tell you about some party that night. We were just living like that, really.
More from Slim Jim Phantom soon. But first of all, are we on the verge of World War III? Kim Jong-un, North Korea's supreme leader, who doesn't look a bit like Diana Ross, he is saying that they are going to attack Guam. Now, on the face of it, it doesn't look like Britain has much in common with North Korea. But when you start looking at it, it turns out that we are almost identical to North Korea. First of all, on the nuclear issue, North Korea has nuclear weapons. It doesn't have anywhere near the amount of nuclear weapons or the capability to threaten the United States. But it has nuclear weapons that can reach the United States. Although the US can obliterate North Korea if they want to, but North Korea have got the capability to make it awkward. That's exactly the same as Britain and Russia. We have a nuclear deterrent, but what have we got? Three submarines. Russia has the capability to wipe Britain off the face of the earth. Their nuclear arsenal is way. If we pick the, we keep you know, saying Russia is our enemy and we've got nukes. Russia must just laugh their heads off at that because they've got way more. But we've got enough to make it uncomfortable for Russia. In the same way that North Korea has enough nukes to make it uncomfortable for America, their enemy. And the similarities don't end there. Kim Jong-un, their head of state, was not elected. Got his job through the family. Our head of state was not elected. Got her job through the family. If you look at what the North Korean people are told about Kim Jong-un and what we are told about the British royal family, there are more similarities. North Koreans are told that Kim Jong-un has supernatural bodily functions. His official biographer stated that Kim Jong-un never needs to use a toilet because his body is so well calibrated, he never needs to urinate or defecate. We're told similar things about the royal family. No one talks about the Queen sitting on the other throne as if she doesn't go. That's very similar to what the North Koreans are told. This is also what North Koreans are told about Kim Jong-un, that he's a fashion icon. We are told that the royals are fashion icons and that the rest of the world copies the fashions that the royal family wear. This one is interesting. Greatness is hereditary. Kim Jong-un is just as amazing as his father, according to North Korean state media, which revealed Kim Jong-un learned to drive at the age of 3. Now, our queen doesn't have a driver's license, but doesn't have to have one. Meaning, she just learned to drive when she was very young. She doesn't even have to have a license plate on any of her cars. Because greatness is hereditary, just like in North Korea. the only difference between Britain and North Korea is that our head of state has a slightly better haircut. Let's check in with Chris.
Graham, electric cars?
Yes.
You're banging on about them day after day.
I am. I'm obsessed with them.
You are?
Yeah.
I don't know if you read the article in The Observer last Sunday.
What did it say?
But there are a lot of problems that have got to be overcome before they can go ahead with this.
What do you mean? They're already going ahead with it. They're already on sale.
But it's not going to be everybody because there just isn't enough. Who's going to power the extra electricity?
Well, there isn't. Once they get them, it was like when petrol cars came along, you had to buy the petrol at the chemist. What happened after after the cars came along, then we got the infrastructure, and that will be the same with electric cars. The bottom line is, it costs an average of 12p a mile to drive a regular combustion engine car. It only costs 2p a mile to drive an electric car. What would you sooner drive?
I'd sooner drive a petrol car.
Why? You shouldn't pay the extra and drive a petrol car. Why?
Because, as you know, I've been a milkman. I've driven electric milk floats for donkey's years.
Yeah, but milk floats... I know, milk floats, that's like 1930s technology, isn't it? 1940s technology.
Yeah, sure.
Modern electric cars are totally different. They, like a Tesla Model 3, which is the new one that Tesla announced this week, it will do over 300 miles on a single charge, and it's not according to
their figures, it's just over 200.
No, there's a long range. They do a regular version and a long range version, and the long range version does over 300. The Tesla Model S already does over 300 miles to the to a charge.
But the thing with Tesla is that they're virtually on the edge of bankruptcy anyway. They are so reliant on their new model now that if it doesn't take off quickly, they will go bust.
But most things are like that. When Sky TV started, he was on he bet the company on putting the satellite up. When Henry Ford started the Ford Motor Company, he put everything into it. This is how change happens when people gamble the farm on everything. So Tesla's not unusual in that respect.
Yeah, but they're not. You're coming into a market that's already there with other technology.
Yeah, that's called disruptive technology. When Henry Ford brought out the Model T, it was horses that were the current model. It was disruptive technology. And this is what we're at the brink of right now with electric cars. We are.
Yeah. The other thing is, probably half the population don't have off-street parking. Where are they going to charge?
There will be charged, like I said, with petrol being used to buy it in the chemist. There will be, like, I live in a block of flats. I park my car in a car park. But one day, there will be a charging point by where I park my car. All that stuff will change when the electric cars come because when petrol cars hadn't come, people go, well, where are you going to fill them up? What about when the chemists aren't? And then petrol stations popped up. Things will change. The infrastructure will come. I drive up to Liverpool every weekend. I do over 400 miles a week. I could own a Tesla right now without having off-street parking at my block of flats where I park in a car park, because Tesla have put an infrastructure in, and between here and Liverpool where I go, there are three Tesla supercharger stations. There's one at Newport Pagnell, there's one at Stoke Services, and there's one at Burton Wood Services. And each one of those, you can put a full charge on the car in 20 minutes. It's a 90% charge. So well over 100 miles I can put on the car. So I would only have to make one stop there and one stop on the way back, and I would still have enough electricity to get me to Bob and back from hitching every day. And that one stop, I have to make a stop because my bladder only has a range of about 140 miles. I have to stop anyway. So by the time I've had a stop, had a wee and a cup of tea, the car will be charged. Right now, Chris, I could own a Tesla even though I don't have off-street parking, and I do over 400 miles a week.
What about the lithium?
What about the lithium?
They make the batteries from lithium, amongst
lithium ion, yeah.
And lithium is very short supply. They need to find extra lithium.
Yeah, they do.
Carry on.
And just like when Henry Ford was building the Model T, they couldn't get the steel, and that's why he made the subframe out of wood. I mean, these things, yeah, they're problems, but that doesn't stop progress. It's coming.
No,
it's happening.
No, I'm not... My point is,
yeah.
You're saying it's going to happen in a few years.
It is.
Well, it's not. It's going to take more than a few years. Unless your definition of a few years is different to mine.
I say this. In three years' time, well, look at Volvo aren't even going to make any cars that don't have electric motors in 2019. That's Volvo, one of the biggest manufacturers in the world. And all the others are right behind it too. And I say in the next 3 to 5 years, most cars, new cars that will be produced will be electric.
And I say
in 10 years' time, most cars on the road will be electric. It's going to happen fast.
We'll agree to disagree, because I don't think it's going to happen that quick, which is why the government has set a time of 2040 on it.
Yeah, well, I don't I reckon it'll happen before that. I don't even think they need that limit.
No, I'm not convinced.
All right.
Anyway.
Chris, I would rather have an electric car. If I could have an electric car right now, I would, and I'm waiting for the Model 3, but they're too expensive right now, so I'm going to wait 3 years when they're 3 years old, and I'm going to buy a three-year-old Model 3 Tesla. That's my plan.
Okay.
All right, Chris.
By which time you'll need new batteries on it, and then
there's an eight-year battery warranty on them, Chris.
Okay, mate. Electric
Avenue, and then we'll take it higher. Was being in the EU so bad that it's worth paying almost $50 billion to get out? That's what it's going to cost. And it'll cost that much because we care too much. The Brexit vote we had over a year ago is one of the worst things to happen to Britain. This week, some Conservative members of Parliament said that they're angry over reports that the Brexit divorce bill will be around $47 billion. Do they really think that the EU is going to make it easy for us to leave? If leaving is cheap and actually good for Britain, other countries will start to leave. And before you know it, there won't be an EU. The European Union have to make sure Brexit is horrible for Britain. But so many people in the UK are in denial over Brexit. One MP said that the EU should be paying us money. The Liberal Democrat Party leader Vince Cable, he seems to have a clearer view of things and blamed the older generation for voting for something as stupid as Brexit. He said that old Brexit voters had, and I quote, shafted the young on the UK's departure from the EU. Writing in the Mail on Sunday, he said that old people had imposed a worldview coloured by nostalgia for an imperial past on a younger generation much more comfortable with modern Europe. Well, right now, the talks are continuing in Brussels about what it will actually cost for Britain to get out. And we have to get out. 52% of the people who voted in last year's referendum voted out. So we can't walk away from the negotiating table and decide to stay. That puts us in a very weak negotiating position. You have to go into any negotiation with the attitude of you care, but not that much. The person who gets the best deal is always the one that's prepared to walk away. And we're not prepared to walk away because we want out. The EU will get the best deal because they are prepared to walk away. As far as Britain's membership is concerned, they care, but not that much. So, it's going to cost Britain whatever the EU says it will cost. And the irony is, most people who voted to leave voted that way because they didn't like the fact that we gave the EU billions every year. A survey's been done about British people's guilty pleasures. Number one was having an extra scoop of ice cream. How's that for quaint? Oh, I shouldn't really have another scoop. Jackie, what's your guilty pleasure?
My guilty pleasure? It definitely wouldn't be an extra scoop of ice cream. An extra tub of ice cream. But definitely not a scoop. That sounds like somebody that really needs to get a grip on life.
Yes, it does. If you're going to go for it, go for it.
Well, I've got to say, my guilty pleasure is definitely having, you know, a glass of wine or two at night.
Right, okay.
Is my guilty pleasure. But I look at it that you know, there's a lot of medical, you know, research that says that having a glass of wine, especially red, is good for your heart.
Yeah. If you read enough research, you'll eventually find a reason to do the thing you want to do.
Well, exactly. I was actually just thinking that I really should go for a walk or something. You know, this time in the morning, I'm up, let's go and do some exercise.
No, exercise is bad for you.
Well, exactly, but it's better to make a cup of tea and just sit, you know.
It is. It brings you more happiness. And they say exercise pays off in the long run. Slacking off pays off right now, and I haven't got time to wait. And they also say that it's never too late to start exercising. Well, good, I'll wait.
British taxpayers have lost millions because of a gigantic scam, and were set to lose even more money because, despite overwhelming evidence, people still refuse to accept that they're being ripped off. A group of con artists are running a racket that costs the British taxpayer $222 million a year. This organisation employs 1,500 staff and has conned the British government into spending $130 million on a gigantic supercomputer that doesn't work. The name of this shonky organisation is the Met Office. They claim to be able to predict the weather. It rained yesterday, and the temperature struggled to get to 61 degrees Fahrenheit. Yeah, in summer. So far, we haven't had anything like a summer. We had a cold and wet July, followed by a colder and wetter August. Here's what the Met Office predicted. These are some quotes from the Daily Express newspaper on the 29th of June this year. Heat wave on the way. Sunshine until September as roasting temperatures to roar back to UK. Met Office predict warmer and drier than average summer. This summer could rival the scorcher of 2003. The next blast of extreme heat shaping up to send the mercury rocketing around the second week of July. Temperatures will remain above average across swathes of England until September. Yeah. All of those predictions, totally wrong. And this happens every year. Every year they predict a hot summer and we get a wet one. Every year they predict the worst winter on record and we get a mild one. If you visit Britain, please be aware of this scam and don't be fooled by anything you hear or read about our weather. The only thing you can predict about Britain's weather is that it's unpredictable. Gary's on the phone. Morning, Gary.
I just want to talk to you about Dunkirk.
Yes. The historic event or the movie?
Well, I went to see the movie.
Yes.
It's the only time in my life I've been to a cinema. And when it ended, I got up and there was numerous people in tears.
Oh, really?
Yeah, including a 66-year-old woman who was absolutely sobbing. And I comforted her and said, they were all heroes.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, yes, so one of them heroes was my dad and he never came back.
Oh, wow.
And personally, it touched me in quite a few ways. The film was somewhat a little bit out, and some were accurate,
yeah.
but also because I had family that were there.
Did you really? Who was there?
My granddad was on the minesweepers,
yeah.
and he was sent to rescue them.
Yeah.
And my great uncle Ted was on the beach. Was one of the 400,000 men that was on the beach.
And did they all come home? Did yours come home safely?
They come home safely, but I know as a child, my granddad used to say to me, I used to say to him, when I'm old, like all children, I'm going to go in the army. And he goes, that's my dead body after what I see happen at Dunkirk. So it haunted him.
Wow.
Because he told me a story that they had two minesweepers going in to pick up troops, and his sister minesweeper, Ronaldo, I think the name of it was,
yeah.
Went in the air where it was hit, where it was torpedoed. So it literally broke it up and sent it up in the air. And he was right next to that. Torpedo right in front of him with troops getting on it. Well, they were, basically, they couldn't bring the minesweepers in because there wasn't, the tide was out.
Yeah.
So they were ferrying troops to the minesweeper. They got on the minesweeper and they were both anchored out at sea with hardly any air cover because, Winston Churchill, honey, sent a handful of aircraft that basically cover the ships because he knew there's going to be losses.
Yeah.
But he went up in the air and all hands on deck lost.
Wow. And how about the bravery of the people who just owned little boats on the south coast, who decided, they weren't military people. I mean, some of them may have been in the First World War, but they were people going out unarmed. They're just doing their bit to rescue these guys on the, that is, it's an incredible story, isn't it?
It's an incredible story. And apparently Winston Churchill said, as long as you bring back, because I've looked at it online, as long as you bring back 35,000 Tommies, English troops,
yeah,
we can rebuild the army. There was 400,000 men on that beach.
Yeah.
There's little bits of it, like, I don't know if you watched a program recently, but Guy Martin in Duxford, got the Spitfire that crashed, crash landed,
yeah.
and it was featured in the film at Dunkirk Beach. They actually dug that original plane up out the beach at Dunkirk and went to Duxford and rebuilt it, and the guy that crashed it, who they basically was a hero, basically.
Yeah.
He was a wing commander, was captured and put in a prisoner of war camp, and later escaped and helped to fight Battle of Britain.
Wow, what a guy!
Yeah, if you look it up, do your research, Graham, you'll see it.
I'll check it out. So you say the film is definitely well worth seeing, and we should all see it, just to remember how brave everybody was.
You should all see it to honour the people that give their life and soul, but also it shows that how wrong Winston Churchill got it. I mean, why would you leave 400,000 men on the beach to defend themselves against Stukas and bombs? And it's unthinkable. You just wouldn't do it.
Yeah. Gary, thank you very much. So you say Dunkirk is something we should all remember, and the movie is definitely worth seeing.
What has happened is a colossal military disaster. We shall go on to the end. We shall never surrender.
The call went out. We have to go to Dunkirk. Ready on the stern line.
What are you doing? You know where we're going.
Into war, George.
I'll be useful, sir.
One of ours.
He's on me.
I'm on him.
The ship's about to leave.
Down you go.
They need to send more ships.
Every hour, the enemy pushes closer.
We've activated the civilian boats.
Civilians? We need destroyers.
Where are we going?
Dunkirk!
I'm not going back.
If we go, they will die.
You're weekend sailors, not the bloody Navy.
You should be at home!
There's no hiding from this, son. We have a job to do.
Turn it around!
We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall never surrender.
We shall never surrender. We shall never surrender.
Where's the bloody Air Force?
The enemy tanks have stopped.
Why?
Why waste precious tanks when they can pick us off from the air like fish in a barrel?
There are 400,000 men on this beach.
He's coming back round.
He's coming back round!
Going.
Dunkirk.
I'm not going back.
There's no hiding from this, son. We have a job to do.
If we go there, we'll die.
Practically see it from here.
What?
Home.
Oh, I'm so annoyed by something in the news right now. The people who are whining that there isn't a traffic light color-coded system of telling you how much sugar is in breakfast cereal. They're saying that the situation is scandalous! Scandalous! They want there to be amber, green and red for sugar-filled breakfast cereal. This organization is called Action on Sugar. Look! Everybody knows too much of anything is bad for you. So too much sugar is bad for you. Everybody also knows which breakfast cereals contain the most sugar. There's usually a clue in the name or the fact that they're aimed at kids. Cocoa Pops, full of sugar. Nobody needs a thing on there that says that. The breakfast cereal formerly known as Sugar Puffs, full of sugar. It's been renamed, you know. It's now called Honey Monster Puffs. Honey is the code word for sugar. So, honey nut cornflakes full of sugar. We know which breakfast cereals are full of sugar. Look, if you want a low sugar diet, you know which ones to stay away from. Stop making it somebody else's fault. Oh, I wouldn't be consuming too much sugar if there was only a traffic light system on the boxes, and the fact that there isn't is scandalous. It's not scandalous, you loser. Why can't people just take responsibility? Everything is your own damn fault, so you can fix it yourself. The power is in your hands. Don't give away that power to somebody else and say because they're not putting labels on boxes, then you're consuming too much sugar. Look, we've had the alcohol content clearly marked on alcohol containers for years. People still drink too much. If you want to consume less sugar, consume less sugar. Don't make it someone else's fault. Get a grip. And I know you think I'm trying to hurt you and your campaign. I'm not. I'm trying to help you and set you free.
A spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. The medicine go down.
Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down in a most delightful way.
How can you tell it's summer in Britain? The rain's warmer. Some parts of the UK have had flooding. The southeast of England's been issued with a yellow weather warning for rain, and there are 14 warnings of flooding across England. Yes, in the summer. Meanwhile, mainland Europe's having a heat wave. Has Europe decided to withhold the sunshine from Britain as part of the ongoing Brexit negotiations? Well, here's the thing. England voted to leave the EU, and it's rained all summer. Scotland wanted to stay in Europe. It's been sunny up there. Let's get to this week's guest on Skype from California. It's Slim Jim Phantom, drummer with the Stray Cats. And first of all, Jim, congratulations on the book, A Stray Cat Struts, My Life as a Rockabilly Rebel. What's it been out, like a year now?
Not quite. It came out last autumn. So yeah, we were gearing up for it about a year ago.
Why did you wait so long to write the book?
Well, somebody asked me to do it, kind of, you know. Left to my own devices, I wouldn't get it together, I don't think. But I wrote the liner notes for a friend of mine and his agent, Dana Newman, who's my agent now, and I've helped her get some other clients, and she helps me, asked me if I would like to, if I had ever written before. And it's one of those things that if you never try, you can't get rejected. And, you know, these days I stick to things that I already am, like, pretty good at, you know, so I don't put myself out there. And so she kind of kept at me, and to write a chapter. And the first one I wrote was about London. It was about going out with Lemmy to the casinos in Mayfair one night and playing slot machines. And fast forward 20 pages, we're paying the taxi driver with coins. Yeah. But the middle 20 pages is who else was there, where we went, where we started the night. So London was certainly a kicking off spot for my book. And so then I wrote another one about I think another little tour of England that we did, or something with the Stones, and then she shopped it, and we got, you know, a few offers. Everyone kind of liked it, and they saw what I was trying to do. That wasn't the exact de rigueur rock doc. It wasn't really hookers and blow. It was more like a little bit of more kind of ironic kind of side to it all.
It's a bit different, though, like writing down a story, an anecdote, to putting together an entire book. What was the process like?
Well, at first I didn't quite get it. I thought you could still have your regular day, watch the TV, talk on the phone, and then all of a sudden run to the next room and write 80 pages really fast, and then go about your then go to lunch. It's really not like that. And they give you little kind of deadlines along the way. You need 5,000 words by tomorrow. It's like school.
Yeah.
You need 10,000 words by tomorrow. And when I kind of started to approach the whole thing like you would playing the drums, then it kind of made sense to me. You got to go, turn off the TV, turn off the phone, sit behind the typewriter for 4 hours. Maybe you'll get three words. Maybe you'll get three chapters. It's just – so when I learned – that's the best way to approach it. And it's, you know, we have these stories that you've been very precious about for years and years. I could take, you know, 5 minutes to tell you, then you write it all down. Well, it's a cozy 7 paragraphs, you know. So there's definitely a way to do it, you know, and you have to learn like anything else. But I think I got it down. If I do another one, I'll be better at it, I think.
Are you thinking of doing another one?
I'd like to. I've remembered a lot more stuff since then, you know. Like at the end of the book, I was better at it than I was at the beginning. So now I know the way a little bit.
Well, let's go back to the beginning then. You grew up in Massapequa, New York.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Massapequa, Long Island. It's about 45 minutes outside New York City, straight shot on the train to Penn Station. And it's, you know, like any other burb of a major city. I'm sure it's like, you know, Hounslow or something in London, you know, or someplace like that, you know, not really too far, but can the kids who want to have a direct access, but a lot of kids don't go that way. A lot of kids would just not engage so much. They stay in the burbs, or they. But we were very like everyone asked me. I've never been to the Hamptons. That's on the other end of Long Island. We were nearer to the city by the train, so we were kids that wanted to play music, and we were always going into CBGBs, Max's Kansas City. All the big music stores were on 48th Street, famous like Manny's, and the drum shops that the big guys would hang out at. So we were always more attracted to going towards the city, but the upbringing and the schooling was very suburban, you know, very much like a urban London. I'm sure it's very much the same thing.
What kind of music were you listening to as a kid then?
Well, as a kid, probably anything I could get my hands on. I had a few older cousins, and one was a girl, so she had like Billy Joel and Aerosmith and that kind of stuff. And then I had another cousin older than me, a boy. We were a pack of like 10 cousins, all kind of Irish, and we all hung out together. And I was like the third or fourth oldest, and so I would get records from my cousins. And my boy cousin, David, he was into the Rolling Stones and Eric Clapton. So I would get those records from him. He was into like British classic rock. And then I had a cousin who, again, I said she was into like what girls would have had in the 70s. And I just borrowed their records and practiced the drums along to it. I didn't really know what I want. I just knew I wanted to play, and records were expensive, so you could pretty much take what you could get.
Yeah.
And this led me till I was about 17 years old, and then I heard rockabilly music, and I liked the Stones and the Beatles and Led Zeppelin and whatever classic rock was around, that the Allman Brothers, Clapton, that kind of stuff. And then that led us to rockabilly, really reading album liner notes of the Beatles and finding out who C. Perkins is. And
yeah,
I borrowed the Blind Faith Clapton record from my cousin, and I had a cover song by B. Holly on it, you know. And, you know, of course, the Stones records are always peppered with C. Berry for Chuck Berry. And, like, I remember we had a Who, maybe Woodstock someone had, like the big triple album that had the Summertime Blues.
Yeah.
So I was this album nerd guy trying to find out about the drums, and, like, that led me to rockabilly, and we loved it. And Brian and Lee, the other guys in the band, are all from my neighborhood. We all grew up very close to each other and from school. And there was one guy that played the bass and one guy that played the guitar, and they were both really advanced musicians. They were very, very good. And around this time, we were going into the city and seeing punk rock bands play. Few bands from England had drifted over. It was right. It was like post-punk. This would have been like late 70s.
Yeah.
That eventually somehow led to Elvis Presley's first record, and then that's when everything changed. For, you know, I saw the look and the style and the attitude of, you know, of the King. You know, the early days of the King, and that just pretty much we all just dropped whatever we were doing and cut our hair, got, you know, pointy shoes and a bowling shirt and some pleated pants, and we were just kind of reinvented musically and how you looked.
Train I ride, 16 coaches long. Train I ride, 16 coaches long. Well, that long black train got my baby and gone. Train, train, coming round, round the bend. Train, train, coming round the bend. Well, it took my baby, but it never will again. No, not again. Train, train, coming down, down the line. Train, train, coming down the line. Well, it's bringing my baby, 'cause she's my own. Mine, she's mine, all mine. Train, train, coming round, round the bend. Well, it took my baby, but it never will again. Never will again.
Can you remember what it was that first drew you to the drums?
I don't know. I was pretty young. Something on television, probably. I don't think I had a Beatles on Ed Sullivan moment. I was kind of young for that one. But it was just something that looked cool, really. There was a few TV shows, I suppose, that would have rock bands on. And maybe American Bandstand was still going. But it was really just something that I thought I could do. And where we lived, a lot of people played. There was I don't know how many of them went on to make a living at it, but a lot of people played.
Yeah.
People had basements with the, you know, drum kit or like a guitar amp, and like a lot of people were into it. So it just seemed like a neighborhood thing to do, and you would always jam with someone. It was a big thing. But I was the one that really took it seriously, and I would hustle up to school dances and playing at keg parties in someone's backyard when the parents were out of town. Like, that was always me and Lee, really, because Lee was my partner since we were really young. We would just practice the bass and the drums together. Just for hours and hours every day. And it just seemed like something that I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to be involved somehow. And very, very early on, I saw people play the piano or the guitar or the saxophone. And like, I didn't think I could do it. Drums, I saw someone do it and I listened to it and I thought I could do it.
Yeah.
It didn't seem quite as mind blowing to me. And then when I eventually talked them all into letting me try it, I was pretty good at it. And then just took lessons and practiced like everybody else.
And you took lessons with a proper jazz cat, didn't you?
Well, yes. I took lessons first at the local music store, which had a very good guy, too. And then that moved up to, I heard that there was a proper old jazz cat. His name was Mousy Alexander. And he really was like a short guy with a goatee that was curled up, you know, on the mustache part. And he really did say daddy-o and cool cat. He really spoke that way. And not too far from where we lived. Like, and he had played with Benny Goodman and Dinah Washington. And he had toured with, like, the U.S. Army jazz band in the 40s and had been to Japan. You know, like, he was a very eclectic guy for our neighborhood, you know?
Yeah.
And he was maybe two train stops over. And so I would get my sticks and my little book, you know, but then he would write the lessons down and I would just go. And it was really like and he had two drum kits in his basement. You'd play on one and he'd play in one. Little tiny basement like everyone else had.
Yeah.
Houses are all the same. But he gave drum lessons in his. And really good experience. I still remember it very, very clearly. And he was just a very, you know, practical guy. You have to practice. You have to learn how to do this. You have to learn how to do that. And, you know. And then he'd regale you with some story of that, you know, he met Gene Krupa. Like, just fantastic wow. stuff, you know.
And when did you start playing standing up?
Well, that was, well, like, a little bit later, I suppose. Well, I mean, all of this is when we were quite young still. Trying to think. Well, when we discovered rockabilly, it was around the same time. Lee and I had a band together, and Brian had a different band. And we started out what became the Stray Cats as like kind of like playing it on the weekends or for fun almost because we loved this music.
Yeah.
And our real bands were doing whatever rock music of the day. So we started to do what became the Stray Cats and we found some old photographs of, you know, Gene Vincent and the Blue Caps, who was our favorite. And, there was a picture of the drummer standing up,
yeah.
Dickie Harrell.
Yeah.
And we said, ah, oh, imagine trying that.
Well, Bebop Luna, she's my baby. Bebop Luna, I don't mean my baby. Bebop Luna, she's my baby. Bebop Luna, I don't mean my baby. Bebop Luna, she's my baby. Bebop Luna, she's my baby. My baby, my baby, my baby. Well, she's the gal in the red blue jeans. She's the queen of all the teens. She's the woman that I know. She's the woman that loves me so. Say, Bebop Luna, she's my baby. Bebop Luna, I don't mean my baby. Bebop Luna, she's my baby, my baby, my baby. Let's rock!
She's the one with the flying feet. She's the one that walks around the store. She's the one that yells, "Mama, Bebopalula, she's my baby. Bebopalula, I don't want my baby. Bebopalula, she's my baby. I'm a baby, I'm a baby, I'm a baby." Let's rock again now. Bebopalula, I don't mean my baby. Bebopalula, she's my baby. Bebopalula, I don't mean my baby. Bebopalula, she's my baby. Bebopalula, she's my baby.
Then we had some, we played a lot of gigs in not established rock clubs, but what we made our own little scene, just regular bars. Not even pubs that had a stage, they were like just bars that had a plug in the back. And we didn't have much gear, so we'd tell the owner, just we have a little PA and one guitar amp, and we'll bring these kids here who like it, neighborhood kids, and you know, just let us play. So we did a lot of gigs, four sets a night, because we loved playing, and we knew every Carl Perkins song, every Buddy Holly song, every Johnny Burnett song, every, so we had a, and we had time, and sometimes you had to move the stuff around, it was very small, so we said, let's try it, the drum standing, like in the Gene Vincent picture, okay, and it was too crowded to, you know, because we were backed into a corner at one gig. Let's put the drums in the front and try to put the, so it was like a bit of trial and error, and as soon as we hit it, we knew that there was something very different about it, and that's, we were trying to do something different, we didn't quite know what, also with a nod to these guys that we loved so much, you know, on these old records, and it was not too much information back then.
Yeah.
Maybe two blurry pictures on a Gene Vincent album. You're trying to base your life on two blurry pictures. You know, like on the back of the Sun Sessions, there might be one little blurry picture of Elvis, and we were just trying to copy, oh, he's got a white belt with black pants, and like just anything we could that was like a link to those guys that we loved it so much, you know. And so when we had the stand-up bass and the drums in the front, and the guitar, you know, we really – we looked at each other immediately. We were onto something.
Yeah.
You know, we're playing a Blue Jean Bop, and you know, three of us in a bar in Massapequa. Like, this is really, we got something here.
And rockabilly wasn't really happening then. I mean, this is, I'm guessing that the mid to late 70s. So the style was all flares and wing collars you must have been outsiders.
Yeah. Nobody knew the word rockabilly was not in the lexicon at all. Later we found out there were Teddy Boys, and that was part of the thing that attracted us to England, that somebody knew what it was, and that Eddie Cochran and Gene Vincent and Buddy Holly and all these guys had toured in England, and there was some type of reference for it. But in New York, see, I don't know about the rest of the states. I don't think so, because we were in New York, which is, you know, the most Cosmo kind of place. Nobody knew what it was. There was a little bit of what would have been like car culture for older guys.
Yeah.
And they would have been playing whatever was on the oldies radio, you know, like Blueberry Hill or, you know, Rock Around the Clock, all great songs. But, like, it was very much just what would have been maybe the American Graffiti soundtrack, a little doo-wop, a little – but nobody looked that way or had any type of lifestyle.
So where did you get the clothing from then?
We went to thrift stores,
right?
Really. There was a few towns over. It was really actually near that you went to the city. There were it seemed to be a little bit more hip. You had to go to the other side of the tracks in a few of these places, and you could find the stuff. You know, pink pants for $2, whatever kind of thing. And they and in the city down in Greenwich Village, they had a few stores that had like vintage used clothes kind of thing, but it was really a kind of, you know, a trial and error with thrift stores and you know, church basement kind of places, you know, and we were really the only ones doing it. So you could go, and if you rooted around enough, find a cowboy shirt, you know, and that kind of stuff. And like, that was part of the thing. We started to make a little money at these bars. just because there was only three of us. You get paid, you know, like a couple hundred bucks, and you had money. And Brian and I shared this tiny little flat, and that was part of the day.
Yeah,
was waking up late after the gig, and eating breakfast at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and then going to the thrift stores and trying to find, a bowling shirt for that night's gig kind of thing. And that was all part of the life that we loved it. It was very innocent, good times.
You ended up with quite a following in New York. You mentioned CBGBs and Max's Kansas City and all the venues. You ended up playing at those venues, but decided to take a big punt and get on a plane in June 1980 and fly to London. Was that because you'd heard about this Ted scene or the resurgence of that?
Positively. Like in New York, like I said, we were playing these bars and actually making money. Everyone thought we were crazy. Okay, you finally, you know, you said you were going to do this. You did. Yeah. We were making $500 a week each, and we're children, you know. It was great. We had a car, and everyone had a nice-looking girlfriend from school, and, you know, that could tolerate the alternative lifestyle of, you know, we slept late. We were like, it was a nice life, you know. But again, you're quite young, and you wanted something a bit more. And CBGB's, Max's Kansas City, there was Hurrah's, there was Gildersleeve. I mean, there was quite a few of those places that you could maybe get a record deal. But this is like 79, 80. It's a bit of a funny time in like music. There's nothing particularly grabbing hold. And you could still only do them once a month.
Right.
Because they were, you didn't want to water your draw down kind of thing. So you had to play Max's on a Tuesday night, fourth on the bill, and hope there's someone from the newspaper there or some record company or, you know. So,
yeah,
you know, maybe it would have happened because we were good and there was starting to be a buzz about it. But we wanted an adventure. You know, we wanted something fast. And we met a couple of English people that were over from England. I said, oh, there's Teddy Boys there. And they got us this book, The Teds. It's still a famous book, you know.
Yeah.
Like and we based our whole life. And we thought that when you got off the plane – everyone was like that. We thought the pilot was going to have a drape. Like, we thought everyone was like that. And, you know, so we sold everything we got one-way plane tickets, and really not such a good plan. We didn't know anyone. We didn't have a phone number, nothing. We just got off the plane in Heathrow, and I'd never even been on a plane before. And it was just, okay, now what? Well, I don't know. You said. And we just, you know, there wasn't much of a plan. So we just.
And did you have like work permits and stuff? Were you legit?
No, nothing. We got the smallest of visa.
Which wouldn't have allowed you to work, I'm guessing, the basic visa.
No, it was just like a tourist to visit for 2 weeks. And it was really, you know, it was all wrong at the beginning.
Well, how did you explain having a guitar and a stand-up bass and drums in your luggage?
Well, we somehow knew enough to split up.
Oh, when you arrived, right? Yeah.
Yeah, Lee somehow got through.
Right,
and he told them that he was going to study music, and that he had an aunt that lived in London. I think he had a girlfriend who actually did have, and so he mentioned some neighborhood.
And at the time, you looked like rockabilly rebels. You didn't blend in really.
We were dressed up.
Okay.
Yeah, and we weren't ever playing the game of like, we were like on the plane with like black and white shoes and, you know, hair combed up, you know, not trying to play the game in any way. So Lee somehow got through. Said he was studying music. He was going to stay with his aunt in Essex or something, you know, and he let him through. Brian and I, some guy came to us and he said, you two are together, don't try this, and put us both in the same line. And Brian and I standing there, you know, what are you doing? I don't know. You know, we didn't have any answers. We didn't even think that far. And so, you know, they just gave us like 2 weeks to get our affairs in order to get in and then leave, you know. So we somehow, and then we just went off the radar, you know. We were,
you jumped ship almost.
Well, yeah, we couldn't go back in 2 weeks. It wasn't, you know, couldn't.
So where did you live in London?
Well, we kind of gravitated towards the middle of town, and we were kind of homeless. Like, we had a little bit of money, so we got some flea bag kind of thing where we all slept in the same bed for, you know, a week or, you know. And then we were kind of rough, to be honest with you. We like stashed the stuff somewhere. I think we met someone that let us like leave a couple of suitcases under a bed. But then we were on our own, really. I remember sleeping outside a bunch of times in Hyde Park on the chaise lounges, and we would stay at movie theaters in Soho because you could pay one time at the beginning of the day and stay all night kind of thing. We couch surf, squats, Sid and Nancy style. You know, we tried to find rock and roll people and rock and roll. We get a copy of Time Out somehow from a bin and look through it and see what gigs were free kind of thing, or, and, you know, go to some gig and try to meet some rock and roll people, and they would tell you about some party that night. We were just living like that, really, and trying to get a gig. And finally we knocked on enough doors and hassled enough people, and we got two or three gigs at like the Fulham Greyhound, the Fulham Golden Lion.
Yeah.
Maybe Dingwalls at the beginning, like – fourth on the bill.
Yeah.
On a Sunday afternoon. You go on at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you know?
Yeah.
So we had met enough people and bugged enough people that when we finally had these few gigs, we got the word out. And I think it was a lot of like, well, we better go see these guys. They've been hanging around for a few months now. Maybe they'll be quiet now. Maybe they'll go home. Maybe they'll be good. Who knows, you know? But let's all go.
Yeah.
And those people were Lemmy, Matt Locke,
wow.
Chrissy Hynde.
Yeah.
You know, those were the people that we had met because they would have been the ones hanging around at the clubs and the parties that we were going to, kind of thing, you know? So we went and played a few of these gigs and, you know, I'm not bashful anymore. We were really good. And we've been playing in New York for a year, five nights a week, four sets a night. So, and we knew our lives depended on it. So back then it was, we're a bit more fearless. Now I'd be more worried about it probably. But like to go and play or go home, eat or starve, to play the drums. So we did the act. And like we were very good at it. And, you know, Chrissy Hynde came and she was, her boyfriend then was Ray Davies, and she told him, and he came down and like couldn't believe how, and he mentioned it in the newspaper. And at the same time, you know, Lemmy, who's my friend ever since that first day, he did an interview and he said something about it. Was just like that.
Yeah,
pretty much. And London, well, England, but especially London, you had NME, Record Mirror, Sounds, Melody Maker, Time Out, all every week.
Yeah,
and they needed stuff, right? You had to put stuff. Now I realize retroactively that like they needed things and we were perfect for it. We had a look, we had a whole story,
yeah,
that you couldn't make up. We are homeless. We lived in that squat in Kensington that's spray painted. That's where we live. So it was a built-in story.
Slim Jim Phantom. More from Jim in a couple of weeks' time. Find out what happened when the Stray Cats became successful, breaking up and getting back together again, and working with the likes of Glenn Matlock from the Sex Pistols and Lemmy from Motorhead. That's all coming up in part two of my chat with Slim Jim Phantom. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Graham Mac. You want to hear more Mac Nuggets? Check out my website, macmedia.co.uk, and subscribe to my Bob FM show on Apple Podcasts. Got a question or something to say? Send me an email. Put your phone number in the email. I might call you back. I might Skype you on the show. My email address is graham@macmedia.co.uk, and you spell Graham like the cracker, Mac like the truck. Until next time, ta-da!